incorporated glass vacuum tubes in their amplifiers, requiring special care in handling. Something as simple as a bumpy ride in the trunk of a car could play havoc with tubes mounted on a galvanized chassis amid the internal bird's nest of wiring. If a case officer opened a crate containing a large reel-to-reel tape recorder and found it did not work out of the box, the entire system was shipped back to headquarters or a tech dispatched to troubleshoot the problem. No body of knowledge, experience, manuals, or testing protocols, either in-house or with the contractors, existed for those early systems. TSS had no method of documenting or benchmarking electronics destined for clandestine operations. The development and deployment processes were ones of trial and error, with a host both of trials and unforeseen errors. The most frustrating challenges were with technical devices that worked perfectly on the test bench, but then failed when installed for an operation. In one early mishap, modified reel-to-reel tape recorders intended for telephone taps were designed to accommodate the waiting period between calls by turning the machine off when the line was not in use. In concept, this innovation saved recording tape, limited the need for constant monitoring at a listening post, and improved the efficiency of transcription. The recorders would start when the call began and switch off when the call ended. In testing, the system met the engineering requirements. Only after deployment was a serious problem recognized. Neither the manufacturer nor the agency anticipated the long wait times between calls. When a call ended, the recorders turned off the motors that advanced the tape, but did not disengage the magnetic heads. The recording heads, it was discovered, heated up after long periods in the pause mode and eventually melted the motionless recording tape pressed against them. For an engineer, this was a small problem easily solved with a screwdriver and a quick change of relays to retract the head from the tape when not recording. However, for a non-technical case officer in South America, the only solution was to call for a traveling tech to change the relays of each recorder at each station. The installation of concealed listening devices sometimes unintentionally pitted the case officers against the techs. No technical skills were required for a case officer to pass a one-time pad and shortwave radio along with instructions for its use to an agent. However, the most basic mic and wire operation, which generally included concealing a microphone, tapping a power line, and running the wire back to the listening post, required a level of technical expertise beyond the typical case officer. While the case officers designed the non-technical elements of every operation, their limited understanding of the technical requirements for a successful installation did not pass without notice. "What are the two biggest lies techs tell?" went the question, followed by the punchline, "The time of my commute to work and the amount of time we tell the case officer the installation will take." Most problems boiled down to understanding the capabilities and limits of the technology. Non-technical case officers, seeing new technologies emerging in the 1950s and 1960s, were prone to either underestimating capabilities or overestimating benefit. Impractical operations proposed by case officers soon became part of the unofficial lore of techs, who diplomatically described the most fanciful of these operations as high-risk options. One courageous case officer suggested a bugging operation that would have him lowered by helicopter onto the balcony of the target's apartment in a major European city. Although dramatic, even movie-worthy, it failed the basic audio operational standard that surreptitious entry be clandestine. A helicopter hovering in central Madrid with a case officer dangling from a rope ladder would likely be noticed. Another proposal involved a tunneling operation in which the managing case officer suggested that the tons of dirt and debris generated could be flushed down toilets and carried away by the city's sewer system. The growing awareness that technical devices offered enormous potential for intelligence collection demanded a new type of case officer-technical officer interface. If case officers were not qualified for the technical phase of most operations, engineers in the lab were equally untrained and unsuited in the basic tradecraft required for field operations. laboratory engineers had neither the training nor experience to plan surveillance detection routes or select usable dead drop sites. As more audio operations were conducted in the 1960s, case officers and audio techs found themselves dependent on each other's skills. Audio techs planting bugs were often in apartments without the knowledge of the resident or on the property of another government. They usually worked under time constraints and the stress of possible discovery. Mistakes and miscalculations were costly because second opportunities for an entry were rare, and no traces of their work could be left behind. Installations of audio devices also frequently called for technical improvisation when the operation was not accurately described in the planning phase or if equipment simply failed. Troubleshooting a short circuit in the bug with a voltmeter at 0200 hours in the basement of a foreign consulate, then cobbling together a fix from a limited selection of spare parts, required a special personality. What the agency needed was a hybrid of the technically oriented, creative, street smart, and pragmatic individual who thrived on adventure. TSS cast its net wide, seeking out likely recruits among telephone companies, military bases, technical schools, and commercial radio stations, along with the emerging television industry. They placed ads in popular technical and science publications without identifying the prospective employer. While these first tech recruits may not have known how to design a new audio device from scratch, they knew how to read a schematic and their way around a soldering iron. They were natural tinkerers who grew up taking radios and cars apart and then putting them back together. As kids, they played with Erector sets and read magazines like Popular Electronics. Several were amateur radio operators who understood the basics of transmitting, antennas, and frequencies. Grant's entrance into spying was typical of that first class. In 1952, he graduated from an electronics school in Kansas City and found a good job as a video engineer at the New Orleans television station WDSU. Then, a few days after receiving his draft notice, whether coincidentally or with other knowledge, a CIA recruiter called with an offer. Although he had turned down the recruiter once before, Grant now responded enthusiastically, took the job, and went on to serve in TSS, TSD, and OTS for more than 30 years. The intelligence contribution of techs like Grant, who thrived on fixing and experimenting with electronics, was imperfectly understood by the agency's senior management. Dr. Herbert Scoville, the deputy director for research in 1962 and 63, reportedly referred to TSD as "those tinkerers" at a staff meeting. The patronizing label received wide circulation within TSD and served to reinforce the tech's identification with the Directorate of Plans rather than with the new Directorate of Research. There was virtually no legacy of experience, and TSS engineers and technicians received little or no formal training in audio operations. Whatever clandestine expertise they acquired occurred on the job. Many of these techs were technically intuitive and given to modifying consumer electronics for their clandestine work. On an assignment overseas in the early 1960s, at a time when public address systems were often built into classrooms, offices, and hotels, a newly deployed tech realized the job of bugging every room in a large hotel was beyond the scope of a single person. However, within hours, he had jerry-rigged a small circuit that turned the room's wall-mounted speakers into passable microphones that picked up conversations at the flip of a switch. The innovation had security advantages beyond efficiency, since the room speakers, usually used for announcements and fire alarms, were part of the woodwork and ignored by patrons. Wall-mounted speakers were not the only type of in-place speakers whose wiring could be reversed. Television sets and table radios could be wired so that their speakers, when not in use, were turned into microphones. The techs could use televisions and radios as concealments for small microphones hidden behind the cloth or grill in front of the speaker. With the transmitter circuitry masked by existing wiring, the audio device drew power whenever the set was plugged into an electrical outlet. When a tech was directed to bug an apartment but could not enter it nor drill through the wall or ceiling to create an air passage, the solution came in the form of a contact microphone. Working on the principle that all hard surfaces in a room vibrate in the presence of voices and noise, placing a sensitive contact microphone on the reverse side of a wall or floor would pick up these vibrations and feed them to an amplifier and tape recorder. The design of the mic was similar to a traditional phonograph cartridge with the needle removed. The tech could hollow out a small furrow in the floor of the apartment above the target, place the microphone in the groove, and cover it with putty to eliminate ambient vibrations. Audio techs had to have a little larceny in their hearts to master skills needed in the field, including picking locks, duplicating keys, tapping phones, and surreptitious entry to gain access to the target sites. "Did we do anything illegal?" Grant recalled. "I guess most of it." Arriving in South America in 1958, an audio tech prepared for an operation to bug the trade office of an Eastern Bloc country. These government-controlled trade offices, functioning primarily outside the diplomatic community, posed as Western-style commercial companies and provided convenient cover for the intelligence officers. The Soviets used both Amtorg, a trading organization, and Aeroflot, their national airline, as covers for espionage. From Amtorg offices, the Soviets conducted industrial as well as political espionage. Throughout the Cold War, the Soviets sought America's advanced technology by targeting individuals in private companies. In 1 year alone, the Soviets' New York residency supplied more than 180,000 pages of classified and unclassified documents, along with samples of state-of-the-art technology. It was a smart way to operate in the West, since a business cover of furthering peaceful trade and commerce offered access to the latest manufacturing equipment and technical expertise, proximity to scientists and engineers who might be recruited, and a platform from which to recruit in nearby countries. In developing countries, where business and politics frequently intertwined, these front companies proved the ideal conduit through which Western economic and scientific secrets could flow back to Moscow. Not surprisingly, these commercial offices were priority targets for agency audio operations. A microphone installation, taps on phone lines, or a telex intercept could yield high-value intelligence about local operations, sources, and recruited agents. Making commercial offices even more attractive was the fact that they were generally less well protected against intrusion than diplomatic facilities. To maintain the facade of a legitimate business, the trading companies leased office space in commercial buildings with security that usually conformed to local business practices. In some instances, the CIA officers would lease space directly above, below, or to the side of these Soviet offices, giving techs a common wall for audio ops. In the South American country, the target trade office was located in a 6-story commercial building in the heart of a major city. Erected before World War II on a main thoroughfare, the building was otherwise unremarkable. Arrangements were made by the local station to rent a small office in the same building to serve as a front. The tech, posing as an employee of the front company, began his technical survey of the building's structure, architecture, layout, and entrances in preparation for an installation. The tech found the stairway door leading to the roof and attic when, unexpectedly, the building's porter appeared. In my best broken Spanish, with a big smile and plenty of hand-waving, I said, "Hey, how can I get up to the attic? There are many windows up there that overlook the city," the tech recalled. "I've noticed how many beautiful churches you have, and this would be a wonderful place to take pictures. I want to photograph as many of your churches as I can." The porter, growing misty-eyed, gestured for the tech to follow him. With his new escort, and communicating as best he could on their trek to the roof, the tech encouraged the porter to show off every possible aspect of the building, stairways, entrances, offices, and crawl spaces. When they finally reached the top floor, the tech found the attic appeared permanently unfinished, consisting largely of unused space, with the partially completed floor offering clear access to the ceilings of the target suite. In short, the vacant attic was the ideal point to plant bugs exactly above the target, and an easy way to run concealed wires back down to the listening post in the agency's rented office several floors below. The tech took a few pictures from the attic window, thanked the porter, again in his best broken Spanish, and left. Returning the next day with a high-quality 8x10-inch photograph of the church across the street, the tech presented the image to the porter, along with a small gratuity. The porter was so pleased, he invited the tech back to take more pictures. With the porter an unwitting source for authorized access, the tech now had plausible reason to be in the unoccupied spaces of the building for extended periods. On the third day, the tech returned with his bag of tools, microphones, and wire, along with a more sophisticated photo system that included a large speed graphic camera and tripod. Positioning himself in the attic directly above the ceiling of the target office, the tech set up his tripod, mounted the camera, and pointed it out the window in the general direction of a church. On the floor was one of the microphones the tech camouflaged to look like a foot switch, with a cord running to the camera. As the tech was about to begin drilling through the floor for the microphone implant, he heard footsteps on the stairs. Quickly repacking his audio equipment, he found himself face-to-face with the porter, accompanied by his entire family, who came in to watch the American take pictures of the city's churches. Clicking the camera, the tech explained that today he would be doing time exposure photography that required several hours to complete. After politely watching the camera and the tech for a while, the family became bored and left. With the porter and his family gone, the tech positioned the mic above the ceiling of the target's office and ran the wire from the microphone through the building's ductwork to the listening post where recorders would be installed. It worked like gangbusters, and for all I know, it might still be there, the tech recalled proudly, decades later. Before 1960, bugging operations were primarily mic and wire jobs, with techs running wires from the implanted microphone to the nearby listening post. In cases where wire could not be run out of a target facility, a concealed recorder was installed and tapes were changed regularly by a support asset, such as a recruited secretary or custodian with access to the target. What the agency needed was a reliable radio signal transmitter from the target to the listening post. There were advantages to each system. The clandestine transmitter eliminated the need to run wires, but usually required regular battery replacement, and the radio signal was vulnerable to sweep teams. The mic and wire jobs were difficult to detect, since they did not emit a radio signal, but the wires took longer to install, and were susceptible to discovery during a physical inspection of the premises. In 1963, a case officer arranged for the tech to have access to a Soviet bloc residence while the diplomat was out of town. The operational plan was to embed mics in the concrete wall of the house, but when the techs began drilling, they discovered their hardware store drills were ill-suited for the task. They made too much noise for middle-of-the-night work. The techs determined that liberal lubrication at the drilling point would dampen some of the sound, and the next day a support officer was sent to the U.S. commissary to buy several gallons of Crisco cooking oil. After dark, the techs returned to the job and repeatedly dipped the drills into the Crisco to keep the hole lubricated. They were rewarded with much quieter drills, but as the drill bits heated in the deepening hole, so did the oil that coated them. Soon, the poorly ventilated house was filled with the odor of fried food, posing a serious operational compromise should the residents unexpectedly return home. While the drill team worked on the wall, two other techs were running the microphone wires across the diplomat's immaculately tended garden and manicured lawn to the nearby listening post. Working only with the available light provided by the stars and moon, the techs dug a shallow trench by hand using bayonets. It was tedious work. Not only did they have to stay on a course plotted across the wide expanse of lawn and flower beds in the dark, they also needed to carefully pick up any loose dirt on the grass and replace each piece of sod or flower as they moved along. Progress moved at a snail's pace as the techs spent the last hour of every night erasing any sign of their presence on the lawn. There was a very conscientious gardener who took care of the landscaping, one of the techs recalled. We installed an observation post where we could watch the house during the day in case the diplomat returned early or visitors showed up. We began noticing that every morning, when the gardener came to work, he'd walk over to the flower bed where we'd been working, look down, shake his head, and go on about his business. Panic began to spread among the techs and case officer. Had the gardener noticed the trench and was biding his time until the diplomat returned to tip him off? The restoration of the lawn looked flawless to the techs, but perhaps the professional gardener noted a disturbance or saw traces of the narrow channel they dug for the wires. Each day, the gardener continued to inspect the flower beds with a worried look, but refrained from poking around in the grass. Finally, the case officer decided the only choice was to attempt to recruit the gardener, since he clearly had noticed something amiss. The plan worked. After the gardener agreed to a covert relationship with the CIA, he heaved a great sigh of relief. "Every morning for the last week," he said, "I come to work, and the red flower would be where the yellow one used to be. The blue one was over here." Because of darkness, the techs did not always recognize the color of the flowers they replanted after digging, and inadvertently rearranged some of the plants. Reassured that he was not losing his mind, the gardener kept the secret, and the installation operation came to a successful end. Chapter 13. Progress in a New Era. A device called a transistor, which has several applications in radio where a vacuum tube ordinarily is employed, was demonstrated for the first time yesterday at Bell Telephone Laboratories at 463 West Street, where it was invented. The New York Times, July 1, 1948, last item featured in the news of radio. The first new audio transmitter developed in partnership between TSS and a private contractor arrived in the late 1950s. Designed specifically for clandestine audio operations, the device was dubbed the SRT, for Surveillance Radio Transmitter. Composed of a hybrid mix of microtubes, sometimes called peanut tubes, that dated to World War II, and recently introduced transistors, the SRT-1 was far from ideal, but a significant leap forward in technology. What operations needed was a concealable, reliable transmitter for audio installations that eliminated the wiring of mic and wire jobs. While the SRT-1 was functional and no longer required wires to connect the microphones to a listening post recorder, it was also the size of a shoebox and required so much power that batteries were impractical in most situations. To make a battery-powered version, the techs tried to modify some of the circuitry and built in a power converter to turn direct current from batteries into alternating current. However, the converters proved to be even more inefficient in terms of power consumption. The result was, in the words of one tech, a power hog to begin with, combined with an inefficient interface in the middle, with a footlocker-sized thing on the back end of it. No wonder the operations guys didn't want to use it. With battery power impractical, techs needed to wire the device directly into the target's power lines to operate for any extended length of time. The greatest value of the SRT-1 was that it benchmarked many characteristics not desirable in a piece of clandestine equipment. Its dimensions were too large for easy concealment, and the in-the-clear signal allowed anyone tuning across the same frequency to pick up the transmission. It offered no remote on-off and broadcast continuously, draining power and making the signal relatively easy to find by hostile technical surveillance countermeasures, TSCM, sweep teams. However, despite the SRT-1 shortcomings, the engineers had created a new capability for remote collection against targets some distance away from the listening post. When the first SRTs were replaced with all transistor units in 1960, covert audio operations multiplied around the world, along with the expertise of the techs. Regardless of whether the audio operation was hardwired or used a radio transmitter, each installation required a carefully planned entry into the target and the right tools for the job. Secure, temporary control of the target site was also required to provide time for installation, including running and hiding wires, constructing antennas, testing the system, and restoring any damage done to the surroundings. These exacting tasks could not be rushed. Frequently, the work was done at night and in semi-darkness. Excessive noise by the techs or the equipment could draw attention and lead to compromise. No debris or tools could be left at the site for later discovery, and wires run through public areas were in danger of discovery. The job was akin to wiring a house for cable television without the occupant or his neighbors ever noticing. To minimize installation time, TSD developed a portable installation device with a razor's edge that allowed the tech to slice open the wall, bury two wires only slightly larger than a human hair, and then close the opening. The compact, fine wire kit could be operated with one hand. In addition to efficiency, the device provided a means to place wires in sections of open walls where no better concealment options were available. Given a choice, the techs preferred hiding wires behind wooden baseboards or chair rail molding, where they were less likely to be discovered and fewer restoration problems arose. For that purpose, techs were issued a lightweight aluminum baseboard puller. L-shaped like a small pry bar, the baseboard puller came in two sizes, the smaller version less than a foot long. It could provide sufficient leverage to create a gap between the wooden molding on a wall large enough to slip the thin wires behind without damaging or leaving marks on either the wall or baseboard. For audio techs, operations in the early 1960s became more numerous, complex, and increasingly audacious. Unstable third world governments, especially in Africa, where colonial governments transferred power to local authorities, added personal risk to clandestine activity. The techs, like other American visitors, were frequently viewed suspiciously and considered to be in league with the colonialists. Audio operations came to the personal attention of President Eisenhower following the downing of CIA pilot Francis Gary Powers' U-2 aircraft over Sverdlovsk in the Soviet Union on May 1, 1960. Before the incident, the techs planned audio operations against the Soviet officials who would be accompanying Premier Khrushchev to the scheduled May 16th European summit meeting with President Eisenhower. The techs bugged several hotel rooms assigned to the Soviet attendees with mic and wire devices. When the summit collapsed after Khrushchev's public denunciation of U.S. spying, the techs received word that the president himself had a collection requirement. Eisenhower, the techs were told, wanted information about what the Soviet reporters from the TASS news agency knew about the cancellation and when they knew it. The president wanted specific information when he met the following morning at breakfast with his security advisors. In fact, among the bugged targets was the room of the chief TASS correspondent. The audio take from conversations in the room revealed that the correspondent had telephoned Moscow after the cancellation to refile the story about the summit he had written before departing Moscow. The audio operation left no doubt in the minds of the techs that the TASS official did not know in advance that Khrushchev would call off the summit. Only infrequently did techs receive feedback on the value or use of the take. Strict standards of need-to-know and compartmentation were accepted as part of the profession by both engineers and tech ops officers. About the time of the scuttled May 1960 summit, the chief of TSD stopped by the bench of one of the lab engineers. "What are you working on?" the chief asked. "A new concealment device," came the reply. "What's it for?" the chief continued. "I'm afraid I can't answer that," said the tech. "I don't know. I have a requirement from operations, and I'm just doing what they want." Another tech who served during the same time agreed. "We had an operational culture that emphasized the need not to know about what our equipment might be used for and what results were obtained, and that's the way we did our jobs." Failure rates in the field of early audio installations were unacceptably high, sometimes reaching 50%. Two primary reasons became apparent. First, on the production end, there were no protocols for testing and certifying performance of components or the integrated systems in place. Manufacturer certification of component performance was accepted as final and considered sufficient. Second, differing field conditions, particularly the temperature and humidity extremes of desert, subarctic, and tropical regions, played havoc with electronic components. Testing was an ad hoc affair in TSS's